Now it's time for Zine. My name is Cora Zon, and joining me is international Zine correspondent Luke Sinclair. Good afternoon, Luke.
Good afternoon, Cora.
So we have a very, very special guest on today. Could you introduce our guest?
So joining us live in the studio today, we have known thinker about zines and known person with a zine habit, Dr. Anna Paletti. Good afternoon, Anna.
Hello, nice to meet you both.
Very excited about today's interview. But before we begin the interview, we'd like to give a definition of a zine. Luke, what's your definition of a zine?
So my own personal definition of what is a zine is that a zine is an independent publication. A zine is a small handmade magazine. A zine is usually made by an individual or a small group of individuals. A zine maker always has full creative control of their zine. A zine is often photocopied. A zine is often stapled. A zine is always made for love and not for profit. And a zine can break one or all of these rules and still be a zine. What do you think of that definition, Dr. Anna Paletti?
I think that's a great definition. I think it captures a lot of what the small community of scholars of zines define zines as. But I think what's really nice about the final clause is that it also recognizes that at the heart of zine making and zine culture is the ability to evolve and for the form actually to be changing and responding. So I like that it's got that caveat at the end, where a zine can also be something that you're not expecting.
I think that that word evolve is so incredible when it comes to zines. That I went to the This Is Not Art Festival zine fair in 2019. That was the last time I went. And when I was there, I was just reflecting upon how different the zine fair was from the first kind of zine fair I went to in Newcastle. I know you were involved in starting that zine fair. How do you think zines have changed since you started that zine fair?
Thanks for reminding me how old I am. I think in some ways zines have changed in the sense that I think there's a lot more visual artists and people interested in design and photography involved in zines now than there were then. I think back then that there were comics artists making zines for sure. So there was a kind of interest in the visual element of zine culture, but there was a lot of collage as well. And there was a lot of like punk writing. Whereas I feel like this aesthetic potential of zines, there's a lot more colour in colour zines than there was then, and there's a lot more zines without words. So there's also more zines that are dedicated either just to sketches and images, kind of artist journal zines, or there's design zines.
So how did you manage when you were helping to start the This Is Not Art zine fair in the late 90s? How did you manage to grab hold of all of these different types of zine makers and get them to come to the same place on the same weekend and act respectfully and friendly and engagingly with each other?
I think this has a lot to do with the person I was working with at the time, Amanda Curley, who is a wonderful person at bringing people together. I'm not much of a host, I have to admit. I don't throw a very good dinner party. I don't usually like trying to organise people to have a good time. But Amanda Curley, who I co-directed the festival with in those years, was great at that. And I think she really knew how to set up the call and the invitation to give the zine fair the right kind of vibe from the beginning. I was much more focused on the banal logistics, like will there be enough tables?
Oh, yeah.
Which I think is an important part of hospitality. I think people do get along better when they know there's a seat for them and there will be enough room for them to display their zines.
And was there enough tables the first year?
Yes, there was. There was. I'm quite proud to say that every zine fair I was involved in always had a nice... We always got just the right number so that there was it was a little bit tight, which is good, but it wasn't too tight. Yeah.
We're going to go to a song. We have let Anna choose all of the music today and has chosen a whole selection of tracks by the Birthday Party. We're going with Mr. Clarinet as the first track.
To Yarra Valley FM 99.1. This is Zine. My name is Corazon. Joining me is international Zine correspondent Luke Sinclair, and our very special guest today is Dr. Anna Paletti. I'd like to know a little bit about your journey into zines. Could you tell us a bit about that, Anna?
Sure. As Luke's already indicated, I first got involved with zines when I was involved in the National Young Writers Festival in Newcastle. And that was when I was at the end of my Bachelor of Arts degree at La Trobe University. I'd studied literature and philosophy, and I was kind of avoiding making decisions about my life. So I went to Newcastle and ran an arts festival for a couple of years to try and work out what I should do next. And I discovered zines through that festival, and I became really interested in them. And I didn't really understand why, as someone who loved literature and who had been reading and learning about literature for a long time, why no one had ever told me about zines. So I was kind of outraged that that zines weren't really considered literature at all in Australia. And then, you know, through a series of, I don't know, accidents, I ended up having the opportunity to apply for funding to do my doctoral research. And I just pitched to Newcastle University, because that's where This Is Not Art was, that I'd like to do a PhD project that investigated zines as a form of literature in Australia. And I was very lucky that Ivor Indyk, who is a very prominent literary publisher in Australia and a lover of experimental writing, had no idea what zines were, but was interested in them precisely for that reason. So he agreed to supervise me, and in many ways he was the ideal supervisor, because he is a lover of good writing and he's an advocate of Australian writing. So he was just super excited. Every time we had a meeting, I'd show him more zines and his mind was blown. And a number of people that I discussed in my doctoral research have gone on to publish books with him, with Giramondo. And he was incredibly supportive of this very fundamental research question I had, which is what doctoral research is, really. You're asking a basic question. And my basic question was, can we think of zines as literature? And I got to prove that we can. So that was my first book, which was based on my doctoral research. And since then, I've been really interested in working as a researcher and as a teacher of literature and annoying my colleagues incessantly about why they only study things they can buy in bookstores. Why do they only study things that are professionally produced through forms of publishing that have, we know, have very strong forms of gatekeeping around them?
I love that. It's really opened my mind about, you know, where we can find literature in terms of studying it. What I'm curious about is, how did you prove that zines are worthy of being called literature?
That's a good question. It's one thing for me to say I proved it, but how? How did I prove it? So the approach I took was to focus in on a particular kind of zine writing, because it seemed to me that zines are so diverse, and I'm sure that your show is proving that. Like every week you're talking to a very different kind of artist. So zines are really diverse, so I decided to focus in on one particular genre of zines, and that is autobiographical zines. And the reason I chose them is because, as I was saying earlier to Luke, there's a very wide range of zines, but personal zines, autobiographical zines, tend to be text-heavy. So I knew that if I focused on personal zines, I'd find zines where there was a lot of writing. And I wouldn't end up accidentally writing on comics, although I did discuss some comic zines in my thesis. So I focused in on autobiographical zines, and then I just applied the existing ideas about how and why autobiography is literature that exists in literary studies already to zines. So the way I proved it was I said, okay, here there's, you know, 50 years of existing scholarship on autobiography and memoir that has really clearly outlined what these forms of literature are. If I apply this criteria to zines, we can see that they are literature. They meet the criteria. But not only that, because of their unique materiality, because of how they're made, how they're circulated, and why people make them, zines tell us something new about autobiography. And that's how you get a doctorate, right? You have to prove something new. So I proved two new things. One was, yes, zines are literature by this criteria. And the second thing I showed to scholars of autobiography is that zines do something unique with autobiography, and that makes them interesting to scholars who are interested in life writing.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
We're going to get another track. This is The Birthday Party with Release the Bat. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Yarraville FM 99.1. This is Zine. My name is Corazon, and joining me is international Zine correspondent Luke Sinclair, and our very special guest today is Dr. Anna Politi. Now, we've been talking about how, congratulations, you proved that memoir in a Zine format can be considered literature. What I'm wanting to dig into a little bit more is, how is memoir considered literature?
This is a good question, because I think the first thing to acknowledge is not everyone thinks that nonfiction writing about lived experience, which is one way to think about what autobiography is literary. But there's been about 50 years of arguments made that have largely shown that it is. And what it means to say that it's literary is, first of all, to recognise that when people are writing about their lived experience for other people to read, there is an enormous amount of creativity and skill involved in that. And I would actually say that the skills required to reflect on and then organise information about your real life are as equally complex and challenging. That is an equally complex and challenging task as writing a novel. Because what you realize when you think about what people do when they're writing about their own experiences is that they're having to reflect on their own experiences, and then they're having to organize a story about that someone else would be interested in, right? So at the basic level, memoir has all the features of fiction. It has a plot, it has characters, it has a narrator, and it has themes. The difference is that all of those key primary aesthetic elements of literature are restricted by real life. This is why I actually have an enormous amount of respect for people that write creatively about lived experience, because unlike fiction writers, memoir writers are held in a contract with reality. They can't make stuff up to make the plot move faster or more interestingly. As I like to say to my students, when people are writing autobiography, if they're talking about their family, they can't leave out the brother they hate. You know, they can't say, yeah, here's a story about my family and pretend that the kind of awkward, annoying brother doesn't exist. They have to work out, how do I include the reality of that brother, you know, in this story that I'm telling? And that requires enormous skill and creativity. So that's kind of a brief sketch of the key parts of memoir, but also why memoir is seen as a creative act inside literary scholarship.
I know that you made zines as part of your PhD project. Can you just tell us a little bit about the zines that you made?
Yeah, so I don't know, there's something about me, and I think it's one of the reasons why I chose three birthday party songs to kick us off, is that in my heart I'm a punk. And what that means as an ethos is that I don't have to be good at something to do it. But I also really felt if I was going to try and genuinely speak to the scholarly community about zines, that the only way I'd really understand what they were and what it meant to make them was to make one myself. So I made a zine called Trade Entrance, and I called it Trade Entrance because I wanted to have something to trade with zine makers, because I wanted to participate in the trade economy of zines. And it was a personal zine about doing a PhD on zines. It was the most meta thing I've ever done. So it was a personal kind of reflection on the very process I was just telling you about, Cora. I was writing about what I was trying to do in my PhD in a way that stripped back all of the academic framework and, you know, all of the wanky stuff I had to, you know, put into the thesis to get people to give me a doctorate. And speak in kind of, I don't know, to everyday people, to zine makers.
You know, I always read Trade Entrance as meaning you were entering into the work of the zines, not as swapping zines. I never even considered that it was about swapping. Mind is blown.
Oh. I love it. Well, one of the things I was curious about in terms of, you know, what is considered literature is the quality of the polish. Zines are very raw. Tell us a bit about that aspect.
Yep. So one of the things I focused on in my doctoral research, and that's in the first book, is this question of spelling mistakes, redaction, so where zine makers will write something and then scrub it out and they'll leave the scrubbed out in, right? They won't remake the page. They'll just leave the visible evidence of them changing their mind in. And I was very interested also in like misphotocopied. So when they photocopy the zine and cut off like the words at the end of the sentence. And my argument was that these things are not evidence of people that don't know what they're doing. That zine makers always have the choice to rewrite a page. They always have the choice to resize the, you know, drop down the photocopying resolution down to 99% so you've got the edge so that everything's included. And that how we should actually read all of these, what some people might think of as errors, are actual material presentations of the process of trying to talk to other people about who you are and what's happened to you. So what I did was look at, for example, a really compelling page in a zine where a woman was talking about the aftermath of sexual assault. And on that page, there was this almost illegible photograph. It was a complete, like it was photocopied, but it was completely blown out. You really couldn't see what it was. Now, to someone who's focused on the idea of aesthetic perfection, that's just a bad job on the photocopier, right? That's a bad choice. But actually, when you read the illegible photographic image, the blown out image, alongside what she's actually saying on the page about the impact of sexual assault on her sense of safety and of her ability to kind of move about in the world, actually this blown out photo starts to really make sense. It starts to really say something that emphasizes and adds to what the text is saying. And that I feel as though that's a really important thing to note about zines.
Yeah, I agree. I think that aspect of it's almost like it becomes an art object that you read in more ways than one as compared to literature that you'll find bound in a book.
And absolutely.
Nothing, it's been edited, it's been polished. It's part of the story, seeing those kind of things in
absolutely.
The scene.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Let's go to another song. This is The Birthday Party with Big Jesus Trash Can.
So much good screaming.
Business.
You're listening to Yarra Valley FM 99.1. This is Zine.
So we're joined live in the studio by Dr. Anna Poletti, who has travelled all the way from the Netherlands just for this interview today. Anna, you have recently published an article through the Minnesota Review titled Making a Loss, the Unsustainable, Unprofitable and Unruly Creativity of Do-It-Yourself. Why are you so mean to me in writing this article is my question.
That's a good question. So that article is forthcoming. So it's about to come out. And if anyone wants to read it, they can contact me via Utrecht University, because it might be behind a paywall. So it might be difficult for people to get access to, and I'm happy to share it with people. Luke's asking why I'm so mean, because I open this article with a description of one of Luke's projects as an example of how zines frustrate traditional ideas about literature. So I give an example of one of Luke's projects, which is an ongoing project, a kind of endless project. And I just point out that one of the core ways that we study literature, and one of the core tenets, if you like, of thinking about literature and teaching literature, is that you could start at the start and get to the end. And one of the things that long-running zine projects like yours, Luke, do is kind of completely disrupt that fantasy, right? You cannot begin or end a serial zine. What you have to do is think about it as a kind of literary stream that you jump into at a certain point and you get out of. But what that means for people that want to study creativity, and this is what I argue in this article, is that we actually have to become more creative with our own ideas about what literature is and how we study it. I don't think it's enough for us to just say, well, I only like studying literature if it fits into my ideas of how literature should be studied. And I think zines are a wonderful challenge to scholars and teachers of literature to change their methods. I don't think it's good enough, really, for us just to say, well, that doesn't fit how I work, so I'm not going to study it. I think we have to say, oh, that's really interesting and creative, and I think it's doing something very interesting. How do I study it? And I don't know, I'm sorry, Luke. I used you as an example of the impossibility of applying existing ways of reading.
No, I loved it. I told my partner that there was an academic article written about me, and I was very excited. And she said, "Oh, what's the article called? What's the title?" And so I read out the title, and it was not as impressive as I was kind of thinking. But my story relating to that is I went to a wedding a while ago of someone I went to high school with, and their mum was at the wedding. And they asked me if I was still working in that funny little shop under Flinders Street Station. And I was really taken aback by that comment. And I said to them, do you mean the internationally recognized important artist-run space, Icky Institute? Is that what you're talking about, that funny little shop? And she just looked at me like, oh, like, why was he invited to the wedding? We should have not invited him. But it was just really interesting, you know, that when, yes. And I guess I have the same feeling when I go up and look at the zines in the collection at the State Library Victoria, where they have them in, you know, temperature controlled rooms in these beautiful display boxes on tram tracks. And what you'll look at it in the box is something that I will have seen on my friend's bedroom floor, you know, underneath their kind of tracky pants and whatever. And here it is, you know, given this level of kind of seriousness and respect that I think it deserves. And I get a little weak at the knees, I guess, when other people give it that level of respect. So do you feel like you're still fighting, Anna?
Fighting. I do. I mean, yeah, I do work best creatively and intellectually if I feel like I'm pushing back against something. I mean, that article that you both read, I feel like is a good article. I'm quite proud of it, and it was why I shared it with you both, partly because I feel like I do a nice job of continuing to fight for this space. But I also feel like I'm fighting – I really feel like I'm fighting for the relevance of the humanities, actually. And that, to me, the internationally recognised artist-run space – Sticky Institute is such a powerful example of what artist-run, not-for-profit spaces do that cannot be quantified by how much money it brings in or what kind of profits it makes or how people benefit from engaging with it. I think there's a clear, when you come to Sticky, there's a clear, it's obvious what is happening here, but I like the way that it resists quantification into kind of policy documents or into what I talk about in this article, which is pretty boring, horrible ideas of the creative industries and what they offer a city. I still feel like I'm fighting, but I'm fighting not just for zines now. I also feel like I'm fighting for the humanities and the intangible value of creativity. And I get very committed.
I got a very exciting email this morning. I'm in the process of ordering some copies of a zine from New York called The East Village Inky, made by Anion Halliday, which I really like. And so I got in touch with them and asked if they'd send some over to Sticky. And so they were like, yeah, they'd love to do that. And they were really excited because we'd be the only Australian distributor of it. And then we were just like, okay, how much are they going to cost? Blah, blah, blah. And we went through postage and everything. And then they came. They were a little sheepish at the end of the email, and they said, well, I'm going to send them all over, but we've done all the maths and you're going to make $15 profit out of this whole endeavor. And I was, you know, really excited to be having these amazing pieces of art, you know, coming to Melbourne when we're going to be selling them in the start of next year. I was a little bit taken aback that was kind of a question in the thing. And if they'd said, well, you're probably going to make a $30 loss, I would have still gone forth and brought them, you know, here. But talking in, you know, degrees of $15 and at the same time talking in terms of something that I consider a very significant project and a very significant work of art is confusing, I guess.
Yeah, really, I agree. I think that quality cannot always be measured by money. I mean, you think about relationships, you can't measure it in terms of money.
Let's go to another song. This is a band who have been in Melbourne the past couple of weeks. This is Dry Cleaning with Scratch Card Lanyard.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to Yarra Valley FM 99.1. This is Zine.
Thanks so much for joining us today, Anna. If anyone out there wants to find out a little bit more about your work, what should they do?
So if people are very interested, they can read the book that was published by Melbourne University Press based on my doctoral research, and that's called Intimate Ephemera, Reading Young Lives in Australian Zine Culture. And interestingly enough, that is a print-on-demand book. So when you order that through the MUP website, they actually go away and make the book for you and send it to you. I think there are also some university libraries in Australia that have copies. And I know the State Library of Victoria also has it, so people can borrow it from there. And the other thing I'd encourage people to do is come into Sticky and put their foot in the stream of literature, especially come in maybe if you're feeling brave and pick up a few copies of You and try and work out where you are in the unending narrative flow that is that project.
And Luke, there's some that you'd like to recommend too?
Well, if you would like a stall at the Festival of the Photocopier Zine Fair, the Zine Fair will be happening on the 11th and 12th of February 2023 at the Meat Market in North Melbourne. If you would like a stall at that Zine Fair, you need to go online and book yourself a stall right now. It's free to have a stall. It's free to come in to the Zine Fair. If you go to any of the Sticky Institute website or social media, you will find a link to the application form there. We would love to see you at the Zine Fair with all of your zines.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Luke. Thank you so much, Anna.
Thanks, Cora.